This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, today marks the 45th annual National Ag Day. It's a recognition of where we get our food. We'll talk with the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences agent to learn more. But first, we're joined today by Professor Jack Goldstone. He's the Virginia E. and John T. Hazel Jr. Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University and a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, Dr. Goldstone was on the faculty at Northwestern University and the University of California, and has been a visiting scholar at Cambridge University, UCLA, UC San Diego, and the California Institute of Technology. We've asked Professor Goldstone to join us in advance of his lecture here at FGCU this Friday evening called Is Democracy in Danger and Should You Care? It's part of the 2018 Dr. Eric Liebert World Affairs Lecture Series. In the interest of full transparency, Florida Gulf Coast University is one of our underwriters. Professor Goldstone, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, great to be with you on the air. I look forward to being with you in person in Florida by the end of the week.
All right. Well, we are talking about global trends in democracy during this part of today's show. If you'd like to weigh in on our discussion, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Jack, let's start with the blurb about this event on the FGCU website. Says that democracy scores around the world in 2017 reached their lowest level in the last 13 years. Can we start by unpacking how those scores are determined?
Sure. Freedom House is an organization that's been monitoring progress or falling away from democracy around the world for about 30 years, really. Started after the end of the Cold War. And what they do is they have panels of experts that rate countries on combinations of civil liberties and political freedoms. Civil liberties mean, do people have freedom of speech? Are they free to assemble? Do they have a right to a fair trial? Then political liberties, are people allowed to vote? Are political parties free to form? Can anyone run for office? So they look at what is the quality of how political institutions are functioning, and what rights do individual citizens have to express and act freely.
So if we're at the lowest level in the last 13 years, that would have been 2005 or so, and we kind of remember what was going on in the world then. Is there a point in time where the scores were the highest? Where do you know where that might be?
Yeah, they actually were moving up for the first decade after the Cold War ended. When communism collapsed in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, a lot of countries around the world, in Latin America, in Africa, decided, well, clearly the constitutional market economies, that is, the NATO powers, have won this struggle. Communism didn't work. So if we're going to become strong modern countries, we also need to adopt constitutional government and follow this pathway marked out by NATO. And a lot of countries adopted constitutions, political parties, competitive elections, and tried to make it work. And the high water mark on that was around 2000, 2001.
How long have you been tracking these trends? How long has this sort of the world that you look at as a professor of what for what you do, when did this start for you?
Well, there are two different answers. As a human being, I, you know, have a short lifetime like everybody else. So I started studying these issues when I went to college, and I've been building my knowledge ever since then. I'm 64 now, so for about 40-odd years, I've been studying and then teaching this material. But it's important to realize that the history of democracy is a global story for humanity, that there is ancient Greece, there are the city-states of Renaissance Italy, and on to how democracy was achieved by revolutions. So collectively, we as human beings have been trying to study democracy and make it work for thousands of years, and I've, in my studies, have reached back to try and understand that whole process.
How did you arrive at the title or theme of this lecture?
Well, my concern is that democracy is not an unstoppable force. My parents grew up in Germany in the 1930s, a Jewish family, but even aside from the issue of Hitler's attack on Jews, in the 1930s was a time when democracy was under attack all over Europe and indeed through much of the world. It seemed at the end of World War I that we had just won the war to make the world safe for democracy. Woodrow Wilson had his famous points for bringing democracy to the world. But within a decade, wham, Mussolini took power in Italy. Hitler, a few years later, took power in Germany. A military government came to power in Japan. Stalin and his purges tightened up Communist Party rule in the Soviet Union. And what had seemed a hopeful new dawn of democracy in the early 1920s, 15 years later, led to a continent in dictatorship and eventually war. Now, look what's happening around the world now. Very similar. We came out of the Cold War as the winners. As I just mentioned, in the early 2000s, it looked like the world was moving our way and everything was moving toward the spread of open democratic societies. But that's now turned around. There are a number of reasons for that, everything from the global recession of 2007 to the mess that America and its allies made out of the Middle East and in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to the incredible economic growth that China has displayed. All of these things have kind of led to a shift in which authoritarian regimes have gotten more confident. A lot of democratic regimes have been gradually kind of whittled away, with authoritarian leaders taking more power for themselves. Certainly, we just saw this in China with Xi Jinping getting rid of term limits. Vladimir Putin was just elected again in what was not really an election, more of a popular affirmation of his accepted right to rule. And even in Europe, we've had the mainstream parties rejected, and in Hungary and in Poland, kind of very nationalist governments elected that are weakening the judiciary, weakening the competitive election process. And so all of this looks worryingly like the kind of step backward that we saw in the 1920s and 30s, except it's happening now.
From your perspective, is it possible to say what the root of this new downward trend is? Was there a point at which a pivot occurred?
Well, historians will always tell you it's dangerous to point to any one thing. The nature of human beings and history is that we're complicated. And if you ask someone, why did you do that thing you did, they might give you a lot of different reasons, and all would be true to some degree. So let me say there are several reasons why we've taken this turn. Some of it was just we thought we had more understanding and control of the world than it turned out that we did. We thought that the business cycle had been banned by clever macroeconomic policy. We did not think we'd ever see a huge business and employment collapse like we saw 2007 to 2009. And when it came, we weren't sure how to deal with it. So some people said we need more deficit spending, more Keynesian pump priming. Other people said, no, we got to just let the business sector cut its losses and get on with things. And so we adopted kind of a compromise. That is, the government did spend money in the United States to bail out the auto companies and to bail out the banks and keep them going. And the Federal Reserve engaged in some new policies, a lot of quantitative easing, buying bonds. But they didn't go quite as far as some people said they should to deal with the magnitude of the crisis. So what we got was not a quick bounce back, but kind of a long, drawn-out recovery during which a lot of people lost their jobs, lost their homes, and didn't get taken care of. Same thing in Europe. They said, well, this is a terrible crisis, but we need to follow austerity policies, force governments to get their books in order, and if that's short-term pain for people, that's the cost of correcting this financial illness. And so there was a lot of pain and suffering that nobody expected, and nobody really explained why did we have to go through this. And that undermined people's confidence in their leaders. That was one thing. at the same time, there was also this huge economic success in China. China was booming. Their economy was moving forward. Chinese exports were competing successfully with products in the U.S. and elsewhere. Factories here were shutting down because Chinese imports were taking up parts of the market. So people felt, not only are we struggling here, but our government's not protecting us from international economic trends that are not in our favor. And finally, we kind of had opened up the world to a new wave of immigration, and that was, I think, good for us economically, good for us in terms of bringing a diversity of skills and cultural approaches to enrich our lives. Everybody now eats sushi. The best-selling condiment in America is salsa, not ketchup. We love all kinds of music. We have a global view of the arts. We enjoy products made around the world. All of that's good, but people do worry about losing their distinctive culture. What is it that keeps America American? Or if you're in France or Germany or Britain, what keeps your community special? And so people have, in addition to the economic problems and the kind of global trade issues, they feel like, wait a minute, can we really manage to absorb all of the immigrants that are in motion around the world? Can we really keep our culture intact? And then lastly, I'd add that the global war on terrorism, which has been ongoing since September 2001, has not really made people feel safe. Instead, we have felt like we're in this decades-long struggle with radical Islam, and it can strike anywhere. And so, boy, we feel under assault in all kinds of ways from all kinds of directions. And so the way out of that is to say, the heck with all of these know-it-all, smart, elite politicians and talking heads who got us here. Give us someone different. Give us a strong leader who will protect us from all of these ills. And whether you're in Russia or China or even Germany or United States, Mexico, there are a lot of people who feel the best thing for us is a tough guy leader. That's an opening for authoritarian leaders to present themselves as national saviors. And the problem with that is, instead of protecting the institutions that make us safe, a strong independent court system, a strong press, a strong balance of powers, limits on executive authority, instead of strengthening those institutions, there's a real temptation to just say, let's have a strong leader, embrace him or her, usually him, and let that leader do what needs to be done. And that idea, that approach, is exactly what we had in the 1930s. And instead of making everybody safe, it led to a dangerous, aggressive nationalism and war. That's what I'm worried about, and that's what I'm trying to say. We don't want to go in that direction again.
We're talking about global trends in democracy during this part of today's show with Professor Jack Goldstone from George Mason University. If you'd like to weigh in on our discussion, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL, and we will get your comment or question on the air. During our pre-interview the other day, you mentioned a quote that you'd recently read from Woodrow Wilson, something about how we are the people who are chosen to show the world the values of liberty and freedom. Can you, A, correct me if I got that quote wrong, and B, reflect on that in light of our current political climate here in the United States?
Certainly, Mike, you took good notes. That's just right. Woodrow Wilson believed America was a chosen people, just like Ronald Reagan felt that America should show itself as a, you know, shining city on a hill. That actually goes back to the Puritan founders of this country, who came to this country for religious freedom and felt that they were creating a new space and a new world where people could be free to follow their faith, to speak their mind, and to get away from the oppression of the old kings and the powerful established churches of Europe. So there's been this long tradition in America of seeing ourselves as a special country that has a special mission to demonstrate to the world what freedom can bring, whether it's material prosperity or a sense of self-worth and confidence, or letting a country benefit from all of the skills and energy and talent that a free people can bring to the marketplace and to politics. So that's our special mission in the eyes of many, many American leaders. Now, the question is, are we living up to that today? And here is where I think we're starting to lose sight of what really counts in terms of that global mission. The United States has often worked with dictators around the world when we had to, but it's never accepted them gladly. And often we have tried to encourage other countries to adopt free institutions, free markets, political parties, the idea that citizens should be sovereign, not the person who holds power. And we seem to be backing away from that. President Trump has been very fulsome in his praise of the leaders of China and Russia, who have a totally different view of what should the balance of freedom be between the government and its citizens. In America, we always believe it's the citizens whose viewpoint is the most important, and the job of the government is to respond to the needs and desires of the free citizens. Whereas in Russia and China, and now increasingly in Turkey and even in Poland, the government believes it's the job of the citizens to follow the lead of the government and to be loyal to the government and to trust the government to manage their lives. Now, the United States has always stood for the opposite of that, and I worry that we're not taking that role seriously in the world these days as we used to.
You know, if democracy requires, engaged, informed citizens, what if we're just not that anymore? I mean, what are the implications of that?
Well, I think we're actually incredibly engaged, and we are richly informed as well, but we're not all informed with the same facts and the same basic view of the world anymore. That has been a real surprise when Mark Zuckerberg presented Facebook to the world. Even before that, when scientists developed the Internet, there was a lot of optimism that these social networks would be liberating by giving voice to so many people and connecting so many people. We would create a vast, single, global community where knowledge flowed freely. It was a beautiful idea. But it turned out to be about as accurate and relevant as the hippie flower power idea of the 60s. In reality, Facebook turned out to be a medium for dividing people. It turned out to be great at creating hermetically sealed communities that reinforced each other's worst viewpoints. It proved to be a great platform for Islamist extremists to recruit terrorists. And it turned out to be incredibly subtle and effective at spreading false and misleading stories, presenting them as truth. Obviously, Facebook has been in the news just the last few days for the way that Cambridge Analytica downloaded and grabbed data from 50 million users and then used that information to target stories, many of them not truthful, to try and change people's views. But that's just one example. Facebook has been used by anyone with an agenda as a means to control the narrative. And there's, no editing. That's been the big problem. There's no editing, no fact-checking. It's become a domain where truth is whatever you want it to be. That's incredibly frightening and damaging for democracy. We didn't see it coming, just like the Great Recession, We didn't see it coming, and we're confused about how to respond to it.
You know, my next question is going to be about where does the Arab Spring uprisings fit into this, but I'm going to link it with what you were just talking about with social media, because as I understand it, a lot of the ways that those things happened or were possible was because of the connectivity that social media allows for. So there's kind of two sides to that. Can you, you know, A, you know, where does the Arab Spring fit in, and what are your thoughts on the way social media facilitated those uprisings?
In fact, scholars have kind of debunked the idea that these were Twitter or Facebook revolutions.
Okay.
In fact, the majority of people who got involved in these uprisings in the Arab world were not digital savvy media users. There was a young generation in the cities, in the upper middle class and professional class, who exchanged ideas on Facebook and created Facebook groups. And some of the initial organizing of rallies and some of the strategy and tactics, where do we meet? Where are the police? How do we avoid the police? People used cell phones and Twitter messages to deal with some of that. But the vast majority of people, young and old, who got involved in the Arab uprisings got their information from satellite TV. They saw uprisings in parts of their country or in neighboring countries on Al Jazeera and thought, wow, that's amazing. I'm seeing it right in front of me on the screen. It's real. We can make that happen here. And that was the kind of big inspiration. That said, why didn't those uprisings continue this wonderful spread of democracy that we saw at the beginning of the 2000s? Obviously, it's a great disappointment to people like myself who hope for and believe in the desirability of more democratic regimes coming into the world. But that disappointment has to be rooted in reality. And the reality is that in these countries, there's been a very strong military, particularly in Egypt, but also in Syria and in Yemen and in Libya. And there was also a very strong Islamist political opposition that maintained itself kind of underground in opposition to these authoritarian dictatorships that tried to keep the opposition suppressed. So when there were these popular uprisings, they put a lot of pressure on these dictatorships to the point where some of the dictators had to run to avoid imprisonment or worse. But what was left in the power vacuum was not a well-developed civil society with a strong middle and professional class to lead the way to democracy. That was the case more in Tunisia than in any of the other Arab countries, and that's why Tunisia is still most successful in working its way toward a democratic type of politics. They've got, God knows, economic problems, they have other headaches, but so far they've had leaders who are willing to work with each other and make the compromises necessary for democratic politics to start moving forward. But in the other Arab countries, once the dictator left the stage, the main actors left were the military and various Islamist oppositions, and they basically went for each other's throats. And so the result was civil wars. You have it in Syria, you have it in Libya, you have it in Yemen, in Egypt. You still have it, but it's mainly in the Sinai Peninsula. That's where the Islamist militias are clashing with the military. The military was strong enough to take control of the Nile Valley and therefore get control of most of Egypt. But that's been the pattern, is the absence of a developed civil society with leadership that understands and is willing to compromise in order to move democracy forward. Without that social stratum being well established, it's very hard to have a democracy develop.
I'm joined by Professor Jack Goldstone from George Mason University. He'll be in town this Friday evening for a lecture here at FGCU called Is Democracy in Danger and Should You Care? It's part of the Dr. Eric Liebert World Affairs Lecture Series. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. One of the posts on your blog, which is called New Population Bomb, explores the question, do appearances matter for democracy to survive? Can you explore your premise in that post a bit?
Sure. Let me just say the reason the blog is called New Population Bomb is my concern with the Arab Spring was, boy, population is growing in the Arab world, in Africa, in South Asia. How are these young people going to find jobs? Are we going to have a civil society developed for them? Are we going to have another set of political explosions? And so that's what that's all about. To come back to your question, appearances matter a lot because one of the essentials for democracy to work is trust. Citizens have to trust each other. Citizens need to trust the government, and the government needs to trust its citizens. Otherwise, paranoia leads to nothing but conflict. Political parties, if they treat each other as enemies and can't talk to each other, can't pass legislation that meets the needs of a majority of their constituents. If people do not trust the government and they're not going to follow its laws, not going to pay their taxes, the government can't function. But if the government is constantly afraid of its citizens and is trying to limit their speech and their organization, you start moving toward dictatorship, not democracy. So trust is essential. And in order to maintain trust, the appearance of fair dealing and fair play is vital. If you don't have that, you create room for conspiracy theories, paranoia, anxiety, and eventual distrust to the point where a democratic system can no longer function. Dangerously close to that in the United States today, some people would say. I don't think we're all the way there, but certainly it would be helpful if our leaders in Congress exhibited more willingness to work with each other and trust each other, and if our president exhibited a greater trust in our core institutions of the press, of his own Department of Justice and FBI, and of the Congress. If everybody's kind of attacking everyone else and attacking their credibility and undermining their trust, seeing conspiracies around every corner, that's not going to strengthen our country as a working democracy or as a beacon to others.
And in relation to the whole beacon for others thing, this the appearances is not just internally, it's how we're perceived by the rest of the world. I read that post over the weekend, and then last night I was catching up on the new season of John Oliver's show on HBO. And in the first episode, he kind of explores the way foreign media is portraying President Trump, and it's not necessarily very flattering. Is this all part of your premise?
Yes, and it's not just President Trump. We have an important movement in this country called Black Lives Matter to call attention to the fact that young black men have been disproportionately the victims of shootings by police, many of them fatal. That's an important issue. But our inability to resolve that has led to America being portrayed in foreign television as a country where the police is at war with its own citizens, and if you're an American, if you break the law, you're liable to be killed. And even repressive regimes say, look, by comparison, our countries are much safer. Our police are much more protective of our citizens than, you know, that in the United States. The same thing with school shootings. If you think school shootings get media attention here, and I'm very sorry to say, we had another tragic school shooting in my neighborhood here. I'm in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
High school shooting in suburban Maryland today. Fortunately, only two students were injured, and the student shooter was killed. There were no other casualties because, in this case, the shooter did not have a semi-automatic weapon. But these events are dramatized and repeated in foreign media to show what a dangerous place the United States is. When I go to China, I meet students who say, Dr. Goldstone, America has great universities. I really like what you're saying. I'd love to come study with you. But my parents won't let me come to the United States because they're afraid for me. They're afraid that every place you go, people have guns and students get shot, whether it was Virginia Tech or high schools or the concert in Las Vegas. All of these things make America look like a country that is badly run, unsafe for its own citizens, and with a government that either doesn't care or is not capable of keeping its own people safe. That's a terrible message for the rest of the world, but that's the one that is being sent out.
On my way into work this morning on the BBC radio, they had a headline about China's President Xi Jinping now being, quote, the most powerful Chinese leader since Chairman Mao. Would you concur with that statement, and what does that mean to you, to the person like you that studies these things?
Well, it's a multi-layered statement, because what do you mean by power? Do you mean power over the population of China? Do you mean power of China relative to the world? I'd say the second one is absolutely true, because China is much richer now than it was under Mao. They have the money to build advanced weapons, to build a large number of ships for a blue ocean navy. They have money to invest in spreading their influence in other countries around the world. So globally, there's no doubt that Xi Jinping is the most powerful leader of China since at least the Second World War, probably going back well before that. The last time China was really a leading global power was in the 1800s. So Xi Jinping stands on top of a China that is able to assert its influence around the world more now than at any time in the last few hundred years. But within China, he's not as powerful as Mao.
Okay.
He's dealing with a bureaucracy that has expanded and is staffed with people who are trained and independent and often are inclined to kind of drag their feet. I mean, one of the reasons that she asked for these changes in the Constitution, give himself more power, take away term limits, restructure the government, is because he's found it very difficult, even as the president of China and head of the party, to actually change facts on the ground in China. He hasn't been able to shut down the overcapacity in coal mining and steel production because local officials all want to keep those businesses going to put money in their pockets. He hasn't been able to persuade local officials to do more about local pollution because it costs those local officials money. It's kind of a surprising thing. We tend to think of this dictatorship as all-powerful, but it's not true. The government, for all of its efforts to control the Internet, for all of its efforts to create a dominant Communist Party, you know, yes, it's able to suppress the Christian churches. Yes, it's able to put human rights lawyers in jail. But it's really not able to reach into everyone's lives the way the Communist Party was under Mao Zedong.
You're a professor at George Mason University. How much time do you spend with students?
Quite a lot. Some of it is in the classroom, but actually most of it is outside the classroom. I supervise a dozen students working on their PhDs. I supervise another dozen students who are working on field exams for their master's degrees. And I correspond with students in my undergraduate and graduate classes about their research projects. So it's hard to put a figure of how many hours a week I spend interacting with students because class time is only about a quarter of it. But, you know, several dozen hours a week.
Well, so my question is what is your sense of this country's political future seen through the lens of your students? Now, I know you're teaching pretty much top-tier students, but, you know, how do you feel about our political future?
I have students actually from all over the world, not just from the United States.
Oh, okay. Right.
George Mason University is one of the most diverse student bodies, has one of the most diverse student bodies of any college in the country, partly because of our Washington, D.C. location. We're in the suburbs of D.C., in Arlington and Fairfax, Virginia. And so we have students from the Middle East, from South Asia, from East Asia, from Latin America, from Europe. So I get a lot of insight, I would say, a real mix. Here's what I get. My students are as smart as they've ever been. They are as engaged as they've ever been. They get more of their information from digital media and social media than they used to. They probably spend less time reading books than they used to, but they are just as engaged, hungry for information, anxious to learn about the world. They're interested in understanding how does recent history and even history from prior centuries affect world affairs now. They are really eager to break down some of these barriers between different countries and to find ways to build cooperation across different communities. But at the same time, they're anxious about their futures. They don't know who to listen to and trust. They don't know for sure that the government of the United States or the government of Great Britain or the government of China really knows what they're doing in terms of managing the national or global economy. They see the stock market soar up, and then it falls down. They've seen Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies explode. Some of their friends became multimillionaires over 18 months, and then all of a sudden, those currencies drop again by half. They are worried about the amount of debt that they have as students. They're worried about whether automation and the changing world of robotics will change the job market in ways that they don't understand. So what I would say is they are really smart and engaged. They're excited about trying to build a better future, but they feel the future is coming at them fast. I don't blame them. I share their concern.
Yeah.
And they're worried about whose values are now going to lead in the world. We can't assume anymore that the free market democracies have the solutions. We don't know if China is going to be the leading power in, when they're adults in 20 years from now. Is it still going to be the United States? Or maybe China will be stronger. They're worried. Is there going to be a nuclear conflict over North Korea? Is there going to be some type of breakup of the European Union? They know the world is changing fast. Nobody knows what changes are going to occur in the next 20 years. And so there's kind of an undercurrent of anxiety that accompanies their excitement.
Well, that is all the time we have for this part of today's show. I want to thank my guest. Dr. Jack Goldstone is the Virginia E. and John T. Hazel, Jr. Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. He joined us in advance of his lecture this Friday evening at FGCU called Is Democracy in Danger and Should You Care? It's part of the Dr. Eric Liebert World Affairs Lecture Series. If you'd like more information about the lecture, go to our website, gulfcoastlive.org. Jack, thanks for your time. I really enjoyed our chat.
My pleasure.
Coming up today is National Ag Day. We'll chat with the University of Florida IFAS agent to find out where we get our food. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida. Stay with us.